Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, hello. Welcome back. Falling Forward episode 21. It's old enough to drink in America now. I'm your host, Dan Lassac. I've never said it like that. I don't know why I said it like that this time. I must be excited. I've given myself a job title. I'm CEO of this podcast. Yeah, I'll put that on my CV when I apply for the job in McDonald's eventually. Can't wait until I have to be a fry cook, guys. Genuinely looking forward to it. So, how have you been? I've been good. Up and down, a little up and down in life, emotionally. I think I always get a bit down after Andrea's been here. Not because she's a bad partner in life or anything like that. It's because she's a good partner. She's a delightful human and I miss her, you know? But that's life. You know, I can't help the fact that she lives 3,500 miles away from me. She could, though. She could win the lottery and move here. But does she do it? Does she do it, guys? No. It's just rude. Thank you, everyone, for coming back and listening. Last episode, Rich Wilson went down really well. People really enjoyed my Essex accent and the jokes and japes that came with it. A little bit of a change of pace this week, more contemplative, as we sat down with SK Slow-Mo, or Sk Shlomo, the looper, beatboxer, entertainer, and now singer, songwriting, producer. We had a lovely chat. He came to my house, which was nice for me, except for the noise of the street, but you'll have to suffer. Guys, I have to suffer it every day. You should suffer it too. We got into the ups and downs of touring and kind of the lows of being a musician as well as the highs. And I'm really grateful that Simon was willing to open up and have that conversation with me. He does it with other people on his live stream / podcast called We Are Listening. So you should Google that. If you don't know Google, go to Ask Jeeves and ask Jeeves what Googling is. And he will tell you. I'm assuming it's just one guy who sits there, but he's really fast at typing. And for once, this isn't a two-parter. But the only reason being is I didn't want Simon to get a parking ticket. That's the limitation on this podcast. I didn't want it to cost him 60 quid to have come to my house to chat nonsense with me. But yeah, I think you're all going to get a lot out of this one. So yeah, I should get out of your way, really. You can listen to myself and SK Shlomo having a little chit-chat, a chin-wag, a natter after this message. This message from me. Hello. This is the message from me. Are you enjoying Falling Forward with Dan Lassac? If so, there are multiple ways to support it and keep it going. First up, the obvious one, patreon.com/DanLassac. That's a subscription thingy. But you can throw $1 at me each month and pay for travel and such and doodah. You could go over to danlassac.bandcamp.com to pick up the music from the show and any of the last 4 or 5 albums I've released. They're all amazing, so you should basically have those already. If you're not free with your wallet, You can subscribe to the podcast. Well, everyone should do that, but you can subscribe to the podcast and maybe leave a review saying things like, oh, that Chandler Sack guy is great. And finally, the easiest and laziest way of doing it would be to hit retweet on the Twitters or share on the Facebook if you're still one of those people tied to the Zuckerberg behemoth. But yeah, they're the ways you can keep this podcast ticking over and filling your ears on a fortnightly basis. Anyway, on with the show.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We've got street noise today as well. Is that like a giant Hoover?
I don't know what's going on.
Someone's hoovering the streets.
Someone's vital maintenance work of street hoovering.
We were very lucky. They closed off the end of that street to do some sewage works, which was exciting. But looks like a quiet street. It's a thoroughfare. And the cars, it was carnage. There were cars backed up for days. It was like Mad Max, but in Reading. It was very exciting. So who are you?
My name is SK Shlomo. I am lots
you
of things.
You weren't always SK, though.
No.
You had to add that.
Yeah, I added the SK because I first was known as a beatboxer, a live beatboxer, and a performer. So I went by Shlomo, which is my middle name, which is a very Jewish name.
Yeah.
Like a really common Jewish name. Which meant that when I wanted to be a recording artist and I typed Shlomo into Spotify, and I was horrified by the... There's many. And so I thought, I can't... Do you know what I mean? I'm going to compete with these people even though they're not me. So yeah, just added my initials, SK, my full name, Simon Shlomo Kahn. So added the S and the K to Shlomo. And then, it took me so long to decide how to change and how to do it and what to change it to, and I just thought it would be such a big drama, and it really wasn't. Like, everyone's just kind of got on with it.
Yeah.
No one's had a problem with it at all.
A band name's like your artist name is a weird thing, because you were it sticks with you for ever.
Yeah,
you know, I remember the very first band I was in, we were called the Ventolins.
Yeah.
And then I changed it to Vent.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere along the line I joined a different band where we could never agree on a name. Mm. So we were like, I think the one gig we did under the name Borealis.
Nice.
But yeah, you just kind of get stuck to them. I was DJ Sackboy up until like a week before the first time me and Pip performed on a build together.
Yeah.
So it could have been DJ Sackboy versus Scroobius Pip.
Yeah.
And that was the first time he heard like any of my remixes of his stuff.
Mm.
In a venue at 3 a.m, which was kind of cool.
And they were Sackboy remixes.
They were
DJ Sackboy.
DJ Sackboy remixes.
I think it's an important part of like adolescence. If you're into music, that's what you do, is you form bands with your friends and you think of the name before you've had your first rehearsal. That's like,
yeah, well, that's
you do that all the time. And oh, he'll be the manager, you will play the bass. Oh, I can't play the bass. Doesn't matter. Like,
well, what I mean? Weirdly, that's what Scroobius Pip's name is. Is before he was, before he had performed, before he had even really taught himself to. I don't think he ever was trying to be a rapper as such. He was always trying to be kind of more on the Gil Scott-Heron thing than an out-and-out rapper. But yeah, before he did any of that, he was Scroobius Pip. And in the HMV we worked in, we formed a band, a rap crew, called the Ridiculous MCs. But there was multiple producers and one rapper. So I was Sackboy. Was I Sackboy at that point? I don't know. There was a guy called Flames Y'all, who's still around now, who produces nice. Hip-hop beats. A guy called Mutt3000, whose name's Matthew, who I don't know if he makes music, but he was one of our producers. And we were grown-ass adults at that point. Yeah. We weren't kids creating a band.
But it's the dream, isn't it? You know,
it's the dream.
Form a band, get a band name.
Yeah.
Go on tour. Go on Top of the Pops, get a Grammy.
You performed as an artist.
Mm.
So you're a looper, beatboxer, shenanigizer for a decade, more than that, before putting the pen to paper as such. Mm. What was it that drove that delay? Why did it take so long to make a record?
Well, I always told myself that it was because what I did was a live art form. And anyone who tried to make beatboxing records hadn't really captured the joy of what they do. Mm. But that wasn't the truth. The truth was that I was afraid of not being good enough. Because even though I'd done lots of writing with other people or for other people, I didn't think I was a good enough writer. Same with production. Same with singing. I was super insecure about singing.
Yeah.
Even though... I know I've got a really lovely voice. I just still struggle to believe that it's good enough to be up on a stage.
Yeah.
The kind of stages that I was getting on. So I'd be happily climbing onto these huge stages, you know, like Glastonbury or whatever, like big, like, same kind of thing you guys are doing. But you guys were releasing records, and I'd be a bit like, I'd kind of sidestepped that whole side of the industry where you have to like get signed or at least get some attention and get your record out and get build a fan base, like. Because of the performance, I could just get on that stage. But I didn't believe that the music I would make would amount to that same level, so I thought I couldn't do it.
Yeah. I think for beatboxers in general, there's definitely a challenge there, because when you're standing on a stage and you make a bass drum come out of your mouth, the audience goes, that just came out of his mouth.
Mm.
As soon as you take away that visual side of it,
mm.
you get into this awkward situation of, well, is this... Now, is that a synth? Or is that, you know... Especially with modern technology, like how much we can process stuff, we can dial in more bass, we can compress... Like, for the audience, they lose that wonderment, you know.
They lose the magic. Like, you wouldn't necessarily, like, watch a magician or, like, listen to a radio show of a magician. Like,
yeah.
You just wouldn't be able to understand. Performance art, it's visual, so then that doesn't mean that the music that beatboxers are making doesn't work without the visual magic, but it can be easy to believe that magic is what makes it good.
Yeah.
And I don't think it is. I think anyone who's an artist, it doesn't really matter what your tools are that you create your art with, and the best beatboxers are the artists. Yes, they use beatboxing, but truly they're creative.
Mm.
And they probably use a whole bunch of other creative skills as well. That's what makes them stand out from other artists. But like, for me, I'd got into a bit of a difficult place where like, I didn't believe that I was doing enough, or I didn't believe that I was seen as serious enough or something like that. Mm. Like, I feel differently now, but I had this real chip on my shoulder that I had to prove myself as like a real artist, which was a really bad starting point to go out and change your whole practice, because it came from a place of like negativity and self-criticism rather than like creative spark and excitement, you know what I mean? So that kind of led me into some difficulties.
I suppose you were also doing all these performances at a time where other beatboxers were trying to, you know, break the recording side. Like Killer Keller is really notable for that, because he had that first record that was very obviously beatboxed, and then that second record that was kind of the Justin Timberlake thing with a live band, and it got really confused. It got really hard to, like, Killer Keller, I saw him performing, I can't remember, we did a gig with him, and it was odd because he came out and did his 6 minute almost like stand up beatbox thing to a rapturous applause, and then the band came out and he did the gig, and he's singing and then doing scratchy noises, but he's got a DJ on stage, so the audience don't care about the scratchy noises that are coming out of his mouth anymore.
I watched all that happen. Like, I just left home and all that was happening, and he'd kind of been a mental figure for a while, so I really looked up to him, and I remember being really disappointed because I felt like I just wanted to see him beatbox.
Yeah.
But now, looking back, I kind of... You can't just do what people want you to do, because then you'll get unhappy with what you're doing, and then the quality of what you're doing will suffer, and your drive will suffer, and the whole project will suffer, and then no one will get anything. So definitely would encourage, looking back, encourage young people or any people who want to develop themselves to do what's in your heart rather than what you think people want. Or even what they do want. Do you know what I mean? Fuck them. Do what you want to do. Yeah. Otherwise you'll be miserable.
Well, that's the thing, because if you're doing what you want and then you happen to have some success, then you get to be happy about it. If you're, I don't know, if you're doing what you think people expect and changing your creative process to fit that, then you're just going to be, you might make some money, but you're going to be sad about it.
Yeah, that's never going to work. Like, imagine taking the soul out of these things that you slaved away to create and then feeling like you had to do them. I didn't really get to that point, but I just thought, like, to me it was more like a self-flagellation thing. It was like, no, I have to not do that to just show that I can do something else.
Yeah.
And then so when I first came out doing a few shows after that process, I kind of did it almost exactly what you just described about Keller, where I did some beatboxing and then I was like, right, now I'm going to do something completely different. And the audience were just a bit like, that my audience were really lovely about it, but I kind of felt bad on them.
Yeah, because they'd come for a thing and they were getting this other thing.
Yeah.
It's definitely a different one, because every band's going to grow. Everyone hates bands' second albums. Yeah. And we always say it's a difficult second album. It's like, well, no, I understand that. The first album took you your whole life to write, so maybe.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think you can't help but grow. You know, if you have success with that first thing, you might have a little more money, so you might have a better kit, and it's going to change slightly. And people are disappointed because they want more of the same. But if you give them more of the same, they're disappointed because you didn't give them anything new.
You can't win, can you?
You can't make anyone happy.
Whenever you try and compare shit, like, whether it's you doing it or the people who are making the stuff for doing it, it's destructive, and it's really hard not to. But if you can try not to, it's generally better.
Yeah. Like I know what I believe to be the best work me and Pip have did or I ever did solo. But I also know that the audience do not agree with me in any way.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's fine, because if someone fell in love with something I wrote, it was not just because of what I wrote. It was because of the life around them at the time. It was because of all the things they'd ever listened to before. It was because of the attractive girl who said, hey, you should listen to this.
There's a million reasons. There's a million stories, isn't there, behind every... It's like synapses. It's so complicated, the connections that go into it. So it's like your experience of a piece of art is never going to be anything like someone else's. Do you know what I mean?
I talk about it with photography. Actually, my dissertation for my degree was about this, about basically how my auntie Pat, without any photographic training, is a professional photographer, in the sense that every image she's ever seen has taught her about framing, about, you know, like, when, as you see, we live in such a visual world that you can't help but be aesthetically trained, you know? And, it was literally my whole degree was just me trying to prove that my degree was useless. And I'm proud of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I stopped doing photography within like 2 years of getting my degree. Hmm. And then worked in HMV. It was all right. Hey, I was an acting manager of HMV Staines at my peak, so...
Living the dream.
Was it Staines?
I don't know the whole story, but was Boris trending on Twitter for saying something about exporting
Jason Donovan CDs to North Korea or
was
something?
Was that a joke or something? I don't understand
what it was. It was probably a joke on his behalf, but Boris is a god at manipulating Google search results.
Right.
Like, yeah. So he'll use phrases that, like, okay, when he talked about painting buses on crates,
right,
that meant that when you search Boris and bus, it was the story about him painting buses on crates, not Boris standing in front of the big lying red bus of Brexit.
Right.
And he's done that a few times.
Just to wipe out all the shit he doesn't want in the Google search.
Basically, yeah. He's very good.
So why does he want to wipe out something about CDs, exports, North Korea, Jason Donovan?
We don't know. not to be paranoid.
It's just so horrible feeling like these manipulative... Oh, I just can't even think about it. It's exhausting. I think
the weird thing is we feel bad about it. It makes us feel tired and sick and agitated. But we actually know now. Like... I'm not saying like Thatcher was manipulating SEO because the internet didn't exist. No. But when this happened 30 years ago, and this has been happening a very long time, we didn't have the opportunity to know. And I think maybe we all feel a little more depressed than our parents did because ignorance is bliss. And because we can see it happening, it's really frustrating. But because we can see it happening, at least we can have that conversation. So when my dad says a thing about Brexit, I can go, "That's, do you know what, Dad? I hear you, but like this is what's actually happening." He's like, "All right, insulin, you say? I didn't realise that, you know." So it's kind of, at least we get the opportunity to challenge it.
Yeah.
But social media plays a huge part in the creative journey for a lot of people. But how do you find it?
I have a really difficult relationship with social media, which I've heard lots of creative people say. But I have recently been trying to pay as little attention as possible, which I think is a lot healthier for me because I noticed that when I've been paying it a lot of attention, it's normally... when I'm having a hard time. It's normally quite a good flag that I'm not doing so great.
Yeah.
I'm putting so much time into paying attention to it.
Is that wanting the dopamine hit? I say a thing and I get a cuddle off people?
You get validation, or you search for validation. Like, that was kind of how it all started for me. Like, I think I recognised that destructive habit a long time ago, so I decided to try to pull away from social media a long time ago. But yeah, it's tricky. And then I feel like more and more people say this, that they've noticed that lots of social media use is linked with when they're not feeling super healthy emotionally or whatever. So then I hear more and more people kind of saying the same thing, that they pay it less and less attention, or if they're creative, they use it to talk about their stuff, but they don't necessarily dive in to what everyone else is saying. I'm like, well, if that carries on as a trend, then the bubble will burst, because it depends on people. It depends on our addictive need for other people's input. Do you know what I mean? Like, Instagram sells your attention. So if you're not paying it attention, it'll eventually implode.
So weirdly, of the social networks, I prefer Instagram because it's the one that doesn't hurt me.
Right.
It doesn't hurt my head.
Okay.
You know, Instagram's the one where I'll scroll and I'll see, I don't know, Amulets doing tape loop stuff and my friend Jake's photography. And, like, it's the one that rarely mentions Brexit.
Yeah, that's really. A good point.
It's the one that, because I suppose it's so much about that photo, I can just scroll it and kind of see things I want to see without getting bombarded by crap. But weirdly, I don't think I use it properly. My girlfriend highlighted the fact that I don't use tags or anything. So I don't look in the music tag.
Yeah.
I just look at the people I already follow. So I've got this really limited, curated experience.
Yeah.
And adverts.
Yeah.
So many adverts.
So many adverts.
Whereas Twitter, you not only can't avoid the shit, you can't avoid people bringing other people's shit in front of you. Like someone, well, Katie Hopkins is an idiot because, and then showing you what Katie Hopkins said. And it's like, yeah, but I didn't want to see what Katie Hopkins said. I don't follow her. She's horrid.
Yeah, I guess Instagram doesn't have the sort of repost function built into it, so you don't get like this, people importing stuff that they care about into your world. But do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, I think since I got back off tour, when I'd been using it every day for my work, and because I post about what I'm doing, which is really positive.
Well, you have to, it's a tool.
You have to, and also I really get a lot from it, and I love that. And I was like, I am fully just addicted to this again. I'm like, if I've got a spare second, I'm straight, like, it's muscle memory, straight onto Instagram or whatever, straight onto wherever I can get some stimulation or some diversion from boredom or whatever you call it. So I was like, right, I'm going cold turkey, and I posted a little, I'm signing out post, and then just deleted all the apps off my phone, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, like all of them gone, and then had a little bit of a detox, and that's been really good. So now I'm back at work, I've been posting when I need to, but I quite often would just delete Instagram after I've made the post, because I just end up going there, and I try and replace that with Kindle app, or listen to an audiobook, or just journaling or something like that, so that when you get that kind of boredom, knee-jerk need for input, it helps you to maybe do a bit of learning if you're going to read a book, or if you're going to write, if you can just write down why you feel fidgety, that can be so good for you. even just a few words. Oh, I'm sad because so-and-so happened earlier. That just acknowledges that little bit of sadness, and then that little butterfly can fly away and you can move on. You might not even need to feel like you need something else to make you feel better.
Do you find, though, sometimes that social media has this ability to, like, positively reinforce your sadness?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have that moment where you're sharing, and obviously people are going to be, the majority of people are kind, but do you then get addicted to that willingness to share?
The kindness?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the TEDx talk I did. That's called How Social Media Saved Me From Suicide. It's talking about how I felt that being able to be open about negativity and, intrusive suicidal thoughts online suddenly created this network of support, which I didn't have before. Do you know what I mean? It's simplifying. The title of that TED talk really simplifies what happened to me, which with any story you tell, you can't tell everything that happened. You've got to simplify the characters. But I still feel that social media isn't actually what's destructive. It's the way that we use it, the way that we pretend like we're great or that we're having a great time.
Yeah, I've said this many times, but like when your friend posts a picture of that amazing meal they're having at that posh restaurant with their partner or whatever on Facebook, they don't follow it up 3 hours later with them taking a dump. Like, the truth of that food is it's going to end up as poop, but we're not painting that picture.
No.
This idealized version of ourselves that we're sharing is great and all. It's nice to feel like you're achieving, but at the same time, for people who feel like they're not achieving, having to see you have all this wonderful food, nice breads and stuff, rustic loaves, with oil and balsamic vinegar,
so artisan,
so artisanal. But you know what I mean, how that false version of your life can make other people feel like they're failing.
I think what's lacking is vulnerability. So it's like, it's great to see someone share their successes, and that could be really heartwarming, but it's also, like you said, it can make you feel like you're less than them. But if someone can also show some truth in the vulnerable side of their world, then it feels more balanced. Then it's like, okay, I saw a really nice TED talk by, is it Joseph Gordon-Levitt? Is that how you say his name? The guy off of, I remember him from Third Rock from the Sun. Now he's obviously a big Hollywood megastar. But he was saying about, he said that he was ashamed of his Instagram, how many Instagram followers he had, because it was so much lower than his Twitter, because he joined way later. And he said he wasn't even going to say the number, which obviously I then went and had a look straight away. And it was 1 million. And I'm like, and he was like, so don't think that the people who you think have made it and are successful, don't think that they're not also having the same anxieties as you.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a lovely bit of vulnerability to share, because I felt so reassured by that. Do you know what I mean? So like, I think that's, that anxiety about how many people are following you is like, is part of the DNA of social media. If people weren't worried about how many people were following them, they'd stop using it, and Facebook wouldn't be able to make money out of us anymore.
Well, and that is the point of social media for the companies that create it. It's an ad servicing platform, you know. Like, most of the internet is just about servicing adverts to us.
And it's completely destroyed all other methods of advertising. Like, we still do some print, and we still do some like kind of traditional publicity, but like the most efficient way to reach the people who are interested in what you're doing is to pay for a targeted ad, because it reaches the people who actually want to see it. And yeah, it's just such a better use of your money.
So my friend B Dolan was over touring with Sage Francis under the name Epic Beardmen, and it was the first time he'd ever engaged with Facebook ads. He used ToneDen, so ToneDen's like
service you can buy the ads through, isn't it?
Yeah, and they do a lot of the sort of tailoring those ads. So you make 6 versions, and it will automatically remove the ones that aren't working and like hone the ads to, you know, optimize it. That's the word. And he was like freaking out, because every show it would only be like 1 or 2 people would come up, but like who hadn't heard anything from him for 5 years. Yeah. And bear in mind, they released 2 albums. He's released 2 fairly big movies.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, he's done stuff that you would think his audience would hear about. But because because they live in this little Facebook bubble, and then he's not advertising to that Facebook bubble, it's made me think that I should run some Facebook ads for the podcast.
But it's horrible. Like, so now if you want to reach anyone, you've got to give money to the evil corporation.
You've got to give money. Even though they chose to already follow you, you still have to pay to talk to them.
It's bull.
Well, this thing, like, this was 2 months ago. I still haven't actually done it because of my own, like, but it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, and yeah, I didn't do it for years because I was the same thing. Also, just it looked quite scary, but it's not that hard to have a play around with, and like you don't have to throw too much money at it to get results. But it has become the only real way you can advertise. Like, it's not that the other old school ways of doing it don't work. It's just that this is so much more effective. It's almost a joke to
like ridiculous. The weird thing about it as well is because of how targeted advertising become. It's actually weirdly like Drowned in Sound have really struggled. The Quietest have really struggled because advertisers don't really need to be on their platform. And that's how they were generating the money to create, you know, arguably good journalism.
Yeah.
So it ends up in this weird, even more awkward situation where more power gets shifted to companies that don't need more power.
Yeah, and they're exponentially taking over more and more of everything we consume. And that's quite scary. And it's kind of, do you know what I mean? You used to watch movies set in the future where that kind of stuff would happen. Do you know what I mean? Like, Back to the Future.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, that will never happen. There'll never be these big corporations that run everything.
Well, someone, you know how in some of those futuristic movies, adverts would become tailored to you as you're walking around the city?
Yeah.
Well, I was reading about Clear Vision, or one of those Clear Channel, one of those advertising, like, billboard advertisers.
Are they going to do that?
Well, no, that there are, on some billboards, on digital adverts, there are sensors to decide whether someone saw the advert or not. Because they can run on, it's like a video screen, because they can run different adverts for different companies, it was their way so that Yves Saint Laurent only pay when they get seen. And so-and-so only pay when they get seen. And it makes perfect sense. Like, yeah. That's how the internet works.
Yeah.
But, like, actually ad impressions in real life.
In the physical world. But also, like, they know who's driving past because you've got your phone there. Like, they like, totally could, like, see you were coming in about 5 seconds' time and show you the ad that's personalised
to you. Show
you
the right ad, yeah.
That's really scary. I don't know why it's more scary than it happening virtually.
But the weird thing about that is it could be a good thing. You know, it could be, like... I really dislike Spotify. I really think the algorithm is dumb. But it's because the algorithm's too good. The algorithm is too precise. So it's like someone seeing you coming and showing you a thing it knows you'll like is a good thing. You like that thing. That shouldn't be bad.
But then it homogenizes it.
Yeah, but because these things are so good at it,
yeah.
How do you ever see something you sort of like? Like, I always talk about the Fugees, Ready or Not.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the Spotify algorithm show you Enya when you listen to the Fugees? You know, like, who is to say that the reason you're listening to the Fugees, Ready or Not, is not because of the Enya sample and not the MCs, you know? Like, the same with Dr. Dre. Why is that? When you listen to Dr. Dre, there's all this soul that he's sampling.
Yeah.
But the algorithm is just, well, Chomo listened to Snoop Dogg after Dr. Dre, so we are going to show you Snoop Dogg. It's like, I get it, but at the same time, I do wish it was slightly wrong. I wish it had this little...
Yeah, because those happy accidents is much more organic, isn't it? Like, real life doesn't go like that. It's not so smooth.
Like, if you went into... I don't know, going to Resident Records in Brighton and say, hey, I really like Mogwai. Can I have some stuff like Mogwai? And they're going to go, depending on who you get at the counter, someone's going to give you Explosions in the Sky or someone's going to give you Godspeed You Black Emperor. But one guy might give you Super Furry Animals. Do you know what I mean? Like, it could, those little misinterpretations... Or personal interpretations feel way more exciting to me than...
I find, like, Spotify... I think Spotify gets quite confused by me because I've listened to such a completely disconnected range of music.
Yeah.
But I also find that I go through waves of it. I remember certain times where it's just fed me loads of stuff and I've got really into it and I've got really excited and I've curated all these playlists of it. And then, like, for example, like, the last few months, I just feel like every time I'm like, I want to find something on there, it doesn't show me anything interesting or new, and then I just get bored and end up listening to the same stuff again.
Yeah.
But that seems to happen in cycles. I don't know if that's me or if it's, like, the technology or what it is, but, like, I still prefer it this way. It's still amazing that you can get anything straight away. I think that's incredible. I think it still blows my mind.
It's value for money as well. It's a bargain. You know. He says.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean? We've got, like, artists who complain about that. Do you know what I mean? It's like complaining about pigeons not being used for delivering mail anymore. Like, some people will.
Yeah.
But you can't make a living off of that now.
That is that thing of who you're angry at. Like, I do think that when I say that Spotify don't pay people enough, I'm not ragging on the audience for using this value for money, decent service. I'm not ragging on the music industry for trying to protect its ass from piracy, which is why they signed the shitty deals they did. I'm ragging on Spotify for not understanding that if they don't support this industry, they fail. They're the ones who end up not making money because people can't afford to make the content for that. The
music. Do you think that's what's going to happen? Do you think it's going to collapse?
I don't think so. I think there's enough at the... That was a good, well-timed pause. Now I have to leave that in. I think there is enough people who are just excited to be making music that Spotify will stay... Really outside car. This is why I don't usually do them here, because it's so damn out. there's enough people making stuff and excited to just be putting things in the world that they'll always have content.
Yeah, I mean, I see that. Like, so, like, going back to right to the beginning of the first question you asked me, which is why did it take you so long to release a record? And part of it was just like, well, it's not going to make any fucking money, is it? So, but this record, I made my album, released it. Like, I was really happy with the streams it got, but it's nowhere near creating any kind of real income.
I think what scares me is those tiny ideas that happen that spark something bigger. You know, there are how dubstep exists comes through a line of things, like stretching all the way back to disco. You know, like this man did this and this happened and that, and then, you know, you get those. Planet Mu did the grime compilations that were actually two-step, but very dubstepy two-step before dubstep. And it's just odd to me, like, how these little things that wouldn't succeed on Spotify inspire entire genres that end up being massive things. Like, how we get from Code 9 to Skrillex is a trackable path. How we get from Code 9 to Skrillex to Britney Spears using dubstep bass lines is a really trackable thing, back to a little nub of Shoreditch in London.
Yeah.
Yet, if that had all been algorithmic, does dubstep ever exist?
Yeah, we'll find out, won't we?
Yeah. Like,
underground music has always been underground. It's always been subversive, and it's always kind of not done what everything else is doing.
Mm.
So it will. It's not going to just die. It'll evolve.
Well, and that's the thing we come back to with like kids watching non-broadcast, like, things just through the internet. Like, maybe we get around the algorithm by, I don't know, like, I use tape machines and stuff, and I haven't used tape machines for 20 years because, you know, it's just a thing I grew out of. But I've got back into that because of the YouTube algorithm. Showed me a German guy called Heimbach, and then showed me another man, I can't remember where he's from, called Amulets, who do really cool stuff with tape loops. And it was like,
got you inspired.
Got me inspired.
That's cool.
And it's like super niche. And they're like, oh, hang on a minute.
I think YouTube algorithmically feels totally different to Spotify. Like, YouTube is about the weird and the wonderful and the anomalies, rather than homogenizing culture.
Well, YouTube is about the social as well. Like, it's about that person's personality, which is why I always think, like, beatboxers, loopers can do quite well on platforms like YouTube, because you get to express your personality, but you can also do things that are a little more, not in a negative sense, but throw away. So you can jump on and do one of the beatboxer old standards, like Teardrop. That's a beatboxer standard. And get a response to that, but without having had to put like 6 months' work into writing this perfectly crafted song and all that. Whereas on Spotify, it's all about that.
Finished. It becomes much more precious, and I think that was really, I found that really hard. I was like, I need to make this perfect. I can't start releasing music until I've perfected it, and then that obviously never happens. So you can only release imperfect things.
Like, this way, I quite like what 65 Days of Static are doing at the moment. They're doing a thing called Year of Wreckage, and it's basically just a Bandcamp subscription.
Right.
$20 for the year, and you get everything they've written. And it's pretty cool, because you're getting to see stuff that maybe wouldn't have made it onto albums, but they're proud of. They want to share. You can end up with a hell of a lot more music than if we waited for them to just make their
perfect vase.
Perfect, yeah.
You ever heard that story about the vases where they got two groups of people, and one group were told they had a week to make one vase. It had to be the best vase they could make. The other group were told they had to make as many vases as they could, and the goal wasn't about quality, it was just about quantity. It doesn't matter how shit they are, to make as many as you can. And by the end of the week, the people who made shit tons of them were making these great vases, and the people who were trying to make one perfect vase, it was awful.
Yeah.
So, like, something that you might think this is too imperfect to go on Spotify, this platform where it has to be shiny and good, so it has to be good enough to stand up to Bon Iver and Kanye, whereas on Bandcamp maybe you don't mind just chucking stuff on that you don't think is finished or good enough.
Other people
might love it.
This is a thing as well. I think we convinced ourselves that there's a perfect pasta sauce.
Yeah.
Like, that, okay, well, I want to make a bunch of money online, so I need to copy Ed Sheeran.
Yeah.
Without realising that Ed Sheeran's the product of a scene. He's a product of the people he was around and being influenced by.
It's a million things.
Maybe Ed Sheeran is a copy of something else, but he's a copy of a lot of other things that influenced him and got him to where he is. So you can't just do Ed Sheeran. We need multiple different pasta sauces. We need a pasta sauce with garlic, whoever that be.
Definitely do Ed Sheeran, but do Billie Eilish as well. And then do everything else that you love and makes you who you are.
Mm.
It's really hard to actually live that advice, but it is good advice. Anything that takes your imagination, steal it and remix it and do your version.
I think that's maybe what we're always doing. As creators, as all creators, you can't live in a vacuum.
Mm.
But maybe we don't admit it sometimes.
Mm.
Like, I listen to older tracks I've done and I'm like, oh, wow, I stole.
I
didn't know I was stealing at the time, but like, I can hear, oh, that song.
Yeah.
That's where that bass line wrote come from. Like, even if it's not the same notes, I know how that made me think and feel, and then I ended up in that spot.
There's a great book I read called Steal Like an Artist. I really like that. It was just about that, just to take everything and do it your way. It's really nice.
Which is, I think, maybe being honest about it. That's the thing.
Mm.
Like, I want to... Hey, I heard John Hopkins, this piano... Okay, I'm going to do John Hopkins today, but see how that my understanding or misunderstanding of what John Hopkins makes translates and comes out the other.
Absolutely.
The sieve of my brain.
Yeah, this is making me want to go and make some shit. I'm in that point now. I've just come off of an insanely creative
120 shows,
and then before that, like, just completely immersing myself in making the record.
Mm.
And now I'm like home again, and I'm like, shit, okay, I want to do more stuff, but I just haven't started. I've got to that thing where I'm like, oh, I'll just come and record a podcast with Dan, or, do you know what I mean? I'll do this, I'll do that. And it's like, that's actually a really important part of the process too. It's just kind of like regrouping and gathering, but it can feel like you're procrastinating or you're not doing enough.
Weirdly, the reason I started the podcast was because of that. It was to stop. It was to give me the dopamine hit of having done a thing every 2 weeks to have feel like I've created something. We're creating ideas here and inspiration. Everyone at home is like writing beats right now.
They're all inspired.
Yeah, they're not even listening to us anymore. But it was also to break the thing I can do of just ignoring the world and watching YouTube or watching Netflix.
Mm.
Actually, the more I watch Netflix, the less I watch TV.
Because
I'm like, if I do the old YouTube thing, like, oh, it's only a 10-minute video, but I'll watch 20 of them. Yeah. Whereas Netflix, I'm very good at controlling myself and going...
Because you watch an episode.
I'm going to watch this one episode.
Yeah.
And it rarely slips over into three. Yeah. Usually slips into two, though.
I'm super strict about that. I do my working day, and then I do my watching stuff, or, do you know what I mean, downtime after that.
Yeah, so because one of the things I do every week is stream on Twitch. So I used to stream 6 nights a week on Twitch, which I've stopped just recently. This is why I've got these two monitors and stuff, and that microphone. And but yeah, now I just do it the weekends. So now I have evenings again, because I didn't have them before, you know.
Is that purely for fun, or is that like a professional goal? Or a bit of both?
I was depressed. I was really... So I was here, me and Pip had finished, and that was done. And then I sat there before I had that sofa, actually. That's my ex's sofa. So I sat there on like a crappy futon for like 8 months. curtains closed, and just played a game called Destiny 1, so before 2 came out. And yeah, it was bad. It was dark. And I've been ill since my teens. I was first diagnosed with depression at 16, 15. First time I had meds was 15. And yeah, just went into my dark place. And I was doing a little bit of work for my friend who's a photographer. And he was just chatting about this other person he had met who plays Destiny and streams on Twitch and seems like fun. And I was like, I'll check Twitch out. And watching his friend Leah, who I'm hoping will be a guest on this podcast at some point, I was like, that does look like fun, you know? And I put it on and I had like 5 viewers the first time. And I was connected to someone. I was talking to other humans about video games.
Yes, it's not just like a dark void. It's like...
Yeah, suddenly I was opening my curtains and all that. So it started as a way for me to connect with the world, especially because I live so solitarily. You know, I've got a few good friends, but, you know, my friend Pete's got a kid now, Jake's got his business to run, you know, like, I don't connect very often. My partner lives 3,600 miles away. So it actually filled a need, the need to actually talk in the day, because I would go whole days without talking. And then it started going well. So I started earning, you know, and like a few $100 a month, and it was growing, and it was good, and it was exciting, and it was like nearly a thing I could have turned into a job. Then Brexit happened.
Oh, really?
And I got really grumpy.
All right.
So I just spent...
Right.
I stopped streaming for like 3 weeks because I was just really like moody. And then when I came back, it was just me being angry about Brexit for months.
Right.
And I just drove half my audience away.
Right.
So, yeah. And then it was just like, oh, damn it, I fucked this. But at the same time, it's making a living as like a Twitch streamer or something is such a pipe dream that I don't feel like I've fucked it up, if you know what I mean. Like, it's fine. You know, so I've lost out on a few $100s.
Right.
It's not like I've lost out on a few thousand.
Yeah.
Because I've seen streamers do that as well. Like, just completely tank their careers from earning, like, tens of thousands a month to nothing.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine how heartbreaking that is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, thank God I wasn't good enough to fuck it up enough, if you know what I mean.
Right.
But now, yeah, at this point, it's just enjoy it. I've got this core of like 20, 30 people who come by who make me laugh. And I get to express the darker side of my sense of humour that I can't express on Twitter. I can't say some of the more crass shit without my tone of voice. You know? Like, I can say ghastly things on Twitch and no one's gonna cancel me, no one's gonna get angry at me because they can hear me. And I've also got a button that brings up a massive banner across my entire screen with the word sarcasm in it, just in case, just in case I'm a bit worried.
So you're using like OBS or something like that?
OBS, yeah.
And then you've got like a MIDI controller that presses that button.
Streamlabs. Stream Deck, it's called, actually. Elgato Stream Deck. It integrates very nicely with OBS, so you can turn on scenes and mute things. And
you might have to show me that after this.
It also acts as a sampler. Not a sampler, but a sample triggerer.
Nice.
So you can have a little, if you want.
Nice.
You know, I will show you. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
I've toyed with the idea of streaming on Twitch, but I'm not a gamer, but just doing my music and my live.
Yeah, creative. The creative... area on there, categories is pretty fertile there. And like, I suppose if you were trying to do it as a to get noticed thing, you might be better off on Mixer, because although it's got like not even 1% the audience of Twitch, it has room to grow, it has room to be noticed. Whereas
I haven't heard of that one. Mixer, is that a new one?
Mixer's Microsoft's Twitch, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah,
because there's always been a few. There's DLive, there's Hitbox, there's a lot. But Twitch just owned it so big, but but yeah, there's definitely some community there.
Yeah, I've never dived in because I've always kind of stayed with the safety net of my Facebook audience. I've done all my live streaming for the last couple of years on there. But every time I meet people who use Twitch, they're just like, oh, it's not scary, just start. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I will, but then I don't. So maybe I will.
But the weird thing is, like, have a Google into it, but there are ways where you can...
Do both
at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. I've looked into that too. Mm.
And then if Twitch suddenly took off, then you know you can go there. Mm. Took my friend Jake Hicks, he was an episode a few ago, guys, go back. He streams occasionally photo retouching and realised that because all of his audience is on Facebook, there's no point in him trying to build something new on Twitch, and he's using it to add value rather than to make a living.
This wouldn't be to make a living, it's just as a... I really loved it when I was, before I was back out on the road, it's kind of transitioning out of, like, when I was struggling with my depression and I wasn't performing at all. I just was, like, desperately trying to make this album. And then that transition between being kind of ready to open the virtual curtains like you did, but not being quite ready to go out on tour. Like, I just started streaming and started doing gigs from that little home studio that I've got. Just little live looping performances or...
See, this thing, the online thing for a beatboxer, for a looper, is kind of like they can see, they can understand, but you're also fluid enough to be able to almost react to what people are saying to you live.
So people are, like, giving me ideas to play around with, and then that was a lovely... Because what you get is it is a performance with an audience, and I've always, since the beginning of my career, I've always understood that value of... When you're working on something, you have to test it in front of an audience. An audience could just be you, could just be Dan.
Yeah, we are performing right now.
Right.
Yeah.
But there's such a psychological difference between rehearsing and performing, and you can't simulate performing unless you have that anxiety of somebody else either being in the room or hearing it or watching it. So I'd always, whenever I've developed new material, I'd always do like warm-up shows. So I'd like either do it to an invited audience, or I'd do like a secret gig, or I'd find some way to do like a low... pressured version of the show, and then you find out where you're going to fuck up, what you need to change, and what's working, blah blah blah. But that's what I love about streaming, is that I can just immediately, like, I don't even have to announce I'm doing it. I can just go on Instagram Live or something and just check this out, guys. Da-da-da-da. Oh, that completely fucked up. Hang up. And like the few people who have watched it, who witnessed that, got to see something that no one else got to see. Yeah. And the fact that you didn't like it means that no one else really had to see it. And then another day you're like, no, I'm feeling really confident about this, so you're starting to build on it, and then you're like reaching an audience, a much bigger audience. It's like, this is great, and I haven't even had to leave my house.
This thing I found hard about doing creative stuff on Twitch was because people would like really want you to really make a finished thing. It's like, well, I don't make finished things. I make a thing and then I let it fester for a few months, and then I go back to it and go, oh, if I take X, Y, and Z from that, I've got this other thing that it'll be perfect for.
Have you ever done that with your music then?
Like, yeah, I did a lot. When I got partnered by Twitch, I was a creative.
Right, so it wasn't just gaming.
Did creative, yeah.
Did you do gaming as well?
I did gaming at first, and then I rolled in more creative stuff, like production stuff.
Sick.
But then it's because it's like... The creative side of me is the nearest thing to the emotional side of me.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was just a little too naked, a little too vulnerable to be sharing it. Mm. And I realised as soon as I started messing around with like drum machines on there, I felt a bit better because it was a little more detached. It was a little less like, well, this is not a finished thing. It's just like a noodling.
As soon as
I got it to noodling, but people found that interesting, I felt far more comfortable than like actually trying to write a melody.
Yeah.
An emotional...
The melody.
Yeah. You know. That's one of the things why, like, I'd never really written lyrics and stuff. Like, yeah, you get people who will sit down and write full songs with their audience. It's like, how do you do that? That seems crazy to me. We talked briefly about doing shows, but you're doing a show for kids at the moment.
Yeah.
So what's that all about? What's all that about?
What the hell's that? Well, I started doing it when I became a dad. I had a really horrible summer, the summer after I became a dad, where I went up to do the Edinburgh Fringe for a month. And my partner and my baby didn't come. And I was like, this is awful. Like, I'm missing my child's development. So I need to find a way that I can do shows but still get home in time for bath time. That was like my little remit that I set myself. So a year later, I came up with a show, which had evolved out of like teaching beatbox workshops. And I noticed that when I do workshops, they'd got more and more slick. And I had a whole little pattern of how I do it. And I had a whole these little stories that made people laugh and that made people engage that I'd refined over the years. And I was like, it basically is a show. I'll just do it on stage. And from the very first show we put on, it sold out. And that was a pattern that just kept repeating. And I was like, shit, okay, there's a market for this. And what I really liked about it was it didn't require any technology. Like, my solo shows had been getting more and more complicated with more and more tech and more advanced. Like, as my mind grew, I was trying to like push that, and it was like, this can be lovely and simple.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how beatboxers end up with so much gear.
Yeah, like,
and I've got eight different loop pedals. Yeah,
exactly
now.
And that's fun, and that's totally valid, but this was lovely just to go back to the basics. And then the show, what I love about that show is it's a show about well-being, but no one needs to know that. Like, it's a show about empowerment and giving children a voice and encouraging them to take an alternative life choice if one feels right for them, even if people around them don't. Because that's the kind of story that I tell of how, you know what I mean, people didn't understand what I meant when I was like, I'm going to be a beatboxer.
Yeah.
They didn't know what it meant. And they said, go back to doing your homework. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm not telling you you have to be a superstar beatboxer, but I'm telling you, please believe in whatever you are. And then I've had quite a lot of adults get really emotional about that and come talk to me about how it touched them. So then I realised this is about well-being for the whole family.
Yeah.
And also it's just lovely because this, as my audience has grown up, like, a lot of them have got kids and can't necessarily come to a nighttime show, and they're desperate to teach their children about bass, so they come into this show, and it's a very joyous thing. I kind of had a bit of a, yeah, I wanted to stop doing it when I wanted to make my album, because I wanted to be seen as like a serious artist. And I was like, that could you, like, all the people I looked up to, like, you know, like Massive Attack, could you imagine like Massive Attack's trip hop adventure for kids? Like, you'd just be like, that would never happen. But after I'd put the album out and I realized I could do all that, I just suddenly relaxed all of that pressure on myself to be something I'm not. Like, I am an entertainer, I am a performer.
I do believe that it's something that the people who are doing something at the fringes of musically, yourself, the DJ Yodas, like, people who are doing something that's music but not traditionally music are given the leeway to do serious stuff and do fun stuff.
That's
like,
nice.
If you look at Yoda's career, like, that is a man going, hey, I'm going to do something really serious today, but tomorrow I'm going to fuck around with the 18 theme for 9 hours. You know?
I love this attitude.
It definitely, I think partially because there's a hook there, because you beatbox straight away. This is not, I'm not trying to teach kids guitar. Shredding adventure for kids. Isn't it? I still think there's room in the world for a metal adventure
I'd
for kids.
I'd go to that.
But you know what I mean? It's like, it's easier for everyone to understand. So you explain it to a theatre and a parent, they all understand what's going to happen. But at the same time, that also means you can work with Bjork or whoever. You get to, which I find fascinating. I find it is a really interesting thing. When you look at your career, you've done a lot. Like, way more than you'd think a beatboxer would be allowed to do.
Sure.
You know, which is pretty amazing when we've all got mouths.
Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of it was just through absolutely unhealthy sheer drive of just like, it was all self-flagellation. Like, I can say it now, I would never admit it at the time, but every time I did something that hadn't been done before, I'd come away and I'd just be even meaner to myself. Like, the fuck, you think that's an achievement? Come on, you need to do something bigger.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like, you've got the world record for the largest beatbox choir, but you've had that multiple times.
Yeah,
you've beaten yourself.
Someone broke it and I was like,
and then you had to break it back.
Yeah.
It's that awkward thing, isn't it? Like, I have achieved this thing and now I have to beat my own achievement, and it's
exhausting.
Why do I have to? Because I've already achieved that, you know.
It's horrible. It's part of it is the artistic mindset. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you were satisfied, you probably wouldn't be creating. So I know a lot of artists don't want to lose that, but like, it is also really horrible. Like, especially if you're, some of the self-talk that I've eventually became kind of more conscious of was horrible. It was fucking hate crime. If I said it to you, you'd A, probably punch me, and B, you'd probably report me for like verbal abuse, emotional abuse. Like, it's not, probably isn't legal. But we do it to ourselves, and artists especially are just so hard on themselves. And it's really, like, and I know it's painful. I know creating is always going to be painful.
But we're hard on ourselves even though it's out of our hands. Like, I could sit down and write the most beautiful piece of music of my life. And to get it to the world, I still have to get past the algorithm. I have to, do you know what I mean? There's still a bunch of things in my way of anyone hearing it, let alone people forgetting that Pip existed, because every time my name's mentioned there, well, they think of him anyway, because they think his name's Dan Lassac a lot of the time.
Right.
But, like, you still got that mountain to surpass, and it's like realizing that you, the harder you beat yourself up doesn't mean that the world suddenly is going to open the door for you. You know, you have to make sure you're well to be able to put music in the world. Like, I don't think I will release music again in anything other than maybe Bandcamp, little things here and there. I don't think there's another album in me because I'm not willing to engage in the world in that emotional way. It's too painful for me.
Do you mean the releasing it part or the writing it part?
The releasing it part. I've written multiple albums that won't get released because I can't deal with the emotional side of releasing a record.
Yeah.
It's too painful. It's too frustrating. You know.
But that's, like, sad. That's so sad. I want to hear those albums. People want to hear them.
Alright. Alright. It's just purely because it makes me feel really sour. And, you know,
there's something unwholesome about it. Hey, listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. Like, do you know what I mean?
That and, like, the frustration when you know something's good. Like the last thing I wrote, 63 Days. There's some music on there that's better than anything I ever wrote. Yet, it will be the thing that the least people have ever heard. I'm at that end of my career anyway, where less people care. Like, less people are engaged with it. Obviously, because there's new music to engage with. You know. And, like, I'm proud of writing it. And I want everyone to hear it. Yet, at the same time, it's like, I'm also not willing to beg. Although I've never been too proud to beg. Weird.
It's hard, man, because, like, part of me's screaming now, like, oh, but if you don't let that stuff out, then there's definitely no way it can succeed.
But
whereas
the thing
if
I've
you let it out and it doesn't succeed, like,
The thing I've come to terms with is it doesn't need to.
Doesn't need to succeed or it doesn't need to be let out?
Either. Like, that's why I will still engage with this idea of releasing things on Bandcamp, like putting it there for people who want it, but not engaging in the dance of trying to make people hear it. Because ultimately, the act of writing it was what made me feel good.
Yeah.
That made me feel like I'd done something.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Like, knowing that I don't have to try to compare or live up to the things I've done previously makes it feel a lot more like I'm willing to make more things, you know?
That does sound way healthier.
Yeah.
I think maybe I'm still, because you've been releasing music for way longer than me, so I still feel like part of the pleasure of, like, I've created some stuff that I really love, and then part of the pleasure is to then share that with other people. And I had this ambition, which I only just achieved about 2 weeks ago, which was I wanted to, because there's so much music that I love that I really identify with and I really like, means so much to me, that if I go and watch that artist play, it's just so special for me. And I just wanted to have that where I would write a song, release it, someone would listen to it enough and engage with it enough that they'd come to see me play and look forward to hearing that song.
Yeah.
And I had, like, someone came up to me the other day and was like, after my show at South Bank, and they were like, I'm so happy you played Invisible. I've had it on repeat for months. And I was just like,
yeah. And it's a surprise as well.
Yeah.
They have that moment where they hear that first strains, first chords or whatever, and it's like,
yeah.
That's why I hate bands who tell you what song's coming up. Like, I like watching an audience go, oh, shit.
It's this one. It's, you know, really exciting.
That moment.
It's a joy. And then, Yeah, like that's, because I'd always get this thing, people would watch me play and they'd be like, oh, I love what you're doing with the beatboxing. I love you and I love your whole character. Music's not really my thing, but I'm still going to come back to the next show. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, so they don't actually like what I'm saying. They just like the way I'm saying it. Or do you know what I mean?
Like, some people are just fascinated by the what went into making it, not the outcome. Which we can do as artists as well.
Yeah.
The amount of artists who will do like a noodly guitar riff, and they're really proud that they have finally got the ability to play that riff.
Yeah.
They forget that maybe that's not music. Like,
it's hard.
It's like, I feel so proud of this, it must be good. When, yeah. You're still engaging with an audience.
Mm.
Is there anything you wanted to get into? I think we've covered a fair amount, to be fair. Are you happy to call it?
More than, yeah.
Are you still putting together the podcast? You did a bunch, but then you've obviously been touring and stuff. Going back to that?
I did that kind of season one, and then my plan was to come back to it like now after I was off tour. It's like a mental health live stream series.
Where can people find that?
It's called We Are Listening, so it's on YouTube and on my website. And it was amazing because it was just an idea I had one day to just like see do creative people want to talk about mental health, and I just sent a few text messages out and went to the gym. And I got back, and there were all these replies, and one of them was from Jason Mraz, like Grammy-winning singer-songwriter. And he was like,
and that was episode one.
He was like, I'm in London in 2 days, let's just do it. And we did it, and 95,000 people watched the live stream, and I was like, shit!
Nice.
I mean, he's got,
had
like,
him on, Bill Bailey.
Yeah,
I think you've had people. Eddie Temple Morris on
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Who's always talking about mental health.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd think you'd be better by now. Sorry, Eddie.
That's it, though. Like,
joke, mate.
It's like, I was doing it for me. Like, I got a lot of lovely feedback out of how many people it helped. Like, loads, and that was really heartwarming, but none of it was for them. It was because I needed a platform to just express myself and see if other people felt the same.
But that's fine. Like, yeah, I need to do a thing. If you enjoy it as a byproduct of me needing to do it, then fucking great.
Great, good.
Yeah.
So then I had all these big designs because I'm always meeting exciting people that I want to sit and talk to. But then I've got home off this tour and I haven't leapt out of my chair to get it started.
You are allowed to relax for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, especially touring. Touring is surprisingly, even if you're not moving that far, even if you're just staying in your country, that constant movement, like sometimes just sitting still is so relaxing, so de-stressing.
It's also hard. I'm finding it hard. I'm just finding myself acting out and fucking getting angry with my family. And like, I'm just like, what is happening? Like, I'm just... It's hard to stop.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, every day you've got people cheering and validating you and and then you just like, just school run. Empty the fucking bins. And I'm just a bit like, I liked it when I only had to look after myself.
Yeah.
And my only goal for the day was to make people shout with joy. Like,
I always talk about, so the thing I miss most from touring, I always talk about in terms of, I used to smoke and I... At the end of the gig, Pip would go stand on merch and I would go stand at the exit of the venue. I would just go walk straight through the crowd, out the front door and smoke.
Mm.
And when I talk about it, it always sounds like it's because I want to like talk to people and connect. And it's that was my favourite bit. And it genuinely, like talking to the audience after a show is always fucking great.
Yeah.
Like I get to, maybe it's an opportunity for me to perform Dan Lassac rather than just the music thing. But part of the addiction to it though was that validation, like someone in right in front of me saying fucking love that,
yeah,
you know. And it is so addictive.
Yeah.
But that doesn't cease to exist.
Yeah.
You know, like when a band stopped making music, that doesn't mean all their music gets deleted. That, you know, that validation. I don't know. I feel like once validated, I wish we could feel it. We could feel validated the whole time. Like we would stay validated, you know, because that person who loved your show and felt great still loved the show now, even though 2 months later you're having to do the bins.
Yeah, but sometimes it feels like that joyful love they had in that moment, and they kind of splat this love onto you, and that feels really nice.
Mm.
But then it gradually starts to like drip down and turn into a mess of all the other sort of old splats.
Gonorrhea.
Basically. It's just... And then...
Well, you could get to the point where I am, where taking the bins out validates you. That's where I've got to. At that point, genuinely, like, I walked into the kitchen earlier and I'm like, yes, I've been on top of the washing up this week.
I have fucking nailed adulting.
Yeah. I am. Look at me.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's hard. But I wouldn't do anything else.
Mm.
They got a point when I was really poorly with my mental health and I was thinking, am I going to have to go and get a job? Am I going to have to, like, provide for my family another way? And it was absolutely heartbreaking.
Mm.
It was just horrible. Because this is part of who I am. And, like, whether or not that's healthy or not, I've done so much exploration of that and comes down to it, like, it is who I am. Like, I kind of feel like doing a show or creating something creative is an act of love, and what you're ending up doing is you're going on stage and you're sharing that love, and when it's going well, the love amplifies the love because the crowd feel it and they throw it right back at you, and it just builds, and I felt like that's what I've got back on this last 6 months of touring, is that feeling of growing momentum of that love. But the safest thing for me is to make sure that I've got that internally and that it's not dependent on all those other people.
And yeah.
All the work. Because I feel like I had built a real unhealthy dependency on my work when I was younger. So now to be able to separate myself from my work, love my work, believe in it, do you know what I mean? Do it justice, but also put it to one side and just love who I am as just a normal guy who empties the bins.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so valuable and hard to do. It takes a lot of practice.
You could beatbox while you were emptying the bins.
Oh, and believe me, I do, boy. It never stops. But like,
just occasionally hope you walk as you take the bin out, someone walk. Are you beatboxing, sir? That is excellent work.
Yeah.
Can you do that bit where they go fresh?
Yeah.
fresh. No, that's scratching. Oh.
My friend's a beatboxer called Testament, and he's been making all this stuff for Radio 4 lately, which has always been his dream, which I'm really proud of him for. And yesterday he released his first drama, Radio 4 drama, and it's called The Beatboxer, and it's about this beatboxer who won the championships, and then it's kind of gone forward in time, and he's like doing a corporate gig. Anyway, yeah. The first few couple of minutes he made me laugh so much because he had to buzz into the office, and the lady wouldn't let him in because she didn't know who he was, and she was like, oh, are you the DJ? Bing! That's the first thing you always get asked when you're a beatboxer. And he was like, no, I'm a beatboxer, I make music with my mouth. And she went, oh, go on, do some for me now. Bing, that's the thing that people always ask. And then the third one, after we did it, she was like, oh, that was amazing. Have you ever thought of going on Britain's Got Talent? I was like, fuck, that's the trio. Every taxi driver, everywhere you go, that's the three you always get asked. So he nailed it. Yeah. Go and listen to that. It's called The Beatboxer. You can stream it on iPlayer.
There you go. We're going to hang up now. Say goodbye.
Bye, love you.
Hello. That was good. It was a very good chat. Really appreciate that. It felt like one of the most honest chats we've had on here. I didn't think either of us were really holding anything back. It was far more a conversation between creators than a conversation about creativity. But I think a lot of these podcasts have become that. Just two people sharing their experience rather than getting into the metaphysical ideas of creativity. I don't even know if metaphysical is the right word there, but it sounded good, you know? It sounded just right. So I'm leaving it in. But yeah, get yourself over to SK Shlomo on Twitter and on the Google box to find more about Simon's work and any upcoming shows. Get the album Surrender in all the usual places. Go have a listen. It's very pretty. Also look at the TEDx talk he did, which is really moving, but actually I won't spoil it, but he delivers it in a particularly SK Shlomo way. But genuinely hope you enjoyed that. As I said before the convo, if you are enjoying it, subscribing to the podcast, writing reviews, hitting up my Patreon, hitting up my Bandcamp, all those things help me to continue doing this on a regular basis. In an ideal world, I'd be able to go back up to weekly and just make this my job forever. But it's not an ideal world, guys. I don't know if you've noticed who's president of the United States, but it's clearly not an ideal world. Unless he's been impeached in the time it took me to record this. Maybe Pence is... No, don't even go there, Dan. Don't even go there. But yeah, thank you all once again for coming by and all the stuff you do. It actually makes me very happy when you say stuff to me on the internet afterwards. Like, hey, Dan, I really enjoyed that podcast. Well done, Dan, and stuff. You know, validate me, basically, if you can. And thank you in advance for spreading the good word. I'm not too proud to beg, but I am too lazy, so that helps me out a lot. And I'll catch you in a couple of weeks. Have fun.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.